Welcome to The Long Box of Darkness, a podcast looking at horror in comic book form. I'm your host, Herman Lowe. Join me as we take a peek inside The Long Box of Darkness. Greetings, listeners. Thanks once again for tuning into The Long Box of Darkness. This is episode 11, and as mentioned in our previous prelude to this episode, we'll be talking about Japanese horror manga this week, specifically the work of Hideshi Hino, one of the greats of the Japanese comic book scene, at least where horror is concerned. And in our previous episode, of course, I gave a brief biography of the author, but we'll quickly do a recap of that. Hideshi Hino was born in Manchuria in 1946. His family fled Manchuria shortly after his birth, and he nearly died en route to Japan. He began to draw at an early age, and in 1967, he published his first comic book strip called Cold Sweat. And then from 1971 onwards, he started a series called Hideshi Hino's Shocking Theater. And there have been 13 volumes published to date. And one of these that we will be discussing today, Panorama of Hell, is his particular favorite. And it's also the first one that was ever translated outside of Japan. And of course, Hino lives in Tokyo, where most of the mangaka, as they call themselves, the manga artists and creators live. And he's still working, to the best of my knowledge. He had a brief stint in film in the early 2000s, but he's always drawing, always creating, always coming up with these sick, twisted fantasies that he's so well known for. So this episode, I have decided to call Hideshi Hino's Opus of Hell, which will cover two of his most famous works, Panorama of Hell, as I mentioned earlier, and his recent Lullabies from Hell. Now, Panorama of Hell was first published in 1982 in Japan, but it was translated in 1989 and published by Blast Books in the States. And his Lullabies from Hell, similarly, was translated much later on, though, in the early 2000s. And it was released by Dark Horse Books. That's when Dark Horse was first publishing lots of horror manga, when they first got into the horror publishing of foreign creators. And it sold quite well. I remember I saw it on one of the Amazon bestseller lists, the comic book bestseller lists at that time. And that's when I bought Lullabies from Hell. And I only acquired Panorama of Hell much later. Still, both books hold up really well, even after the 16 or 17 odd years that I've read it, and very disturbing. So, listeners, prepare yourself to be grossed out, shocked, appalled by the images that I will be describing and the themes that I will be discussing, themes that crop up again and again in Hideshi Hino's work. So, without further digression, let's get into this. Hideshi Hino's Opus of Hell.
Thank you.
The cover of the first book, Panorama of Hell, that we'll be talking about, has Hideyoshi Hino's full grotesque artistic talents on display here. It features a face of a man as a centerpiece and two severed hands floating in the ether, pulling off the skin, ripping it off of this face, revealing the orbs beneath the eyes filled with bloody veins. And the top of the head has been removed, and out of it is peeling these two zombie-like death masks filled with maggots where the eyes should be, maggots pouring out of the nostrils, stuff like that. Hideyoshi Hino's really obsessed with grotesque images of decaying, zombified flesh, if I can put it that way. So, suitably horrific cover. The back cover has a quick synopsis of what you can expect in Panorama of Hell. They say, Panorama of Hell is a shocking, torturous journey into the depths of one man's post-nuclear hell. Okay, so basically, Panorama of Hell is a type of fictional autobiography of Hideyoshi Hino himself. It features Hideyoshi Hino as a mad painter obsessed with rendering images of hell, which he dreams about and which he in fact sees all around him. And you don't know if this is real or is this just a hallucination of him, because he's clearly mad. But he uses his own blood to paint his masterpieces. He cuts himself, collects the blood in jars and in buckets, and then, you know, once he's recovered suitably from the blood loss, he paints these horrific images of hell. So you've got him introducing himself in the very first story and then showing you his process of bleeding himself and painting these images. And then you've got him sort of introducing his environment or his neighborhood. He lives in this kind of a shanty, but it's quite large. It's got a couple of rooms. We'll find out later he has a family in there as well. But nearby, there is a guillotine. It's a field behind his house, a barren field with a guillotine where the condemned are decapitated on a daily basis. And this guillotine has led to a type of industry of a sort, because it seems that the heads are being processed in some factory while the headless cadavers are burnt in a crematorium. And this supplies a lot of jobs to the local industry, it seems, because this happens on a daily basis. There's an endless stream of the convicted and the damned, so to speak, being beheaded. And they show some graphic images of this guillotine in action, and also of the heads being collected and taken away on a type of train. Then, you know, the blood that drips from the train cars themselves, obviously coming from these severed heads, they fall on the tracks and grow into these blood flowers, bloody blooms, as Hideyoshi Hino describes them. And then these embryo-like birds, they're completely featherless. They feed on the leaves and petals and even fruit that's grown from these blood flowers. So then we get to the first chapter. That was all just an introduction to Hideyoshi Hino's biographical, you know, rendering of himself as this mad painter, which he might really be in real life. How would we know? But then the first chapter is called The Bottomless River of Hell. It seems that his house is surrounded by a river filled to the brim with corpses of animals and people and broken toys, bicycles, old tires, and other detritus. It's horrible, really. You've got all these weird things that you can find in this river, even some manga, some comic books by presumably fellow mangaka artists. And you've got these grotesque frogs feeding on the dead flesh of these cadavers. And you've got, you know, other animals inhabiting this river of blood also feeding on the frogs. And then you've got snakes. You've got caterpillars, centipedes, lizards, all kinds of creatures living here, and they all engage in this ridiculous circle of life and death by eating each other and being eaten in turn. And then he quickly introduces the incinerator, the crematorium of headless corpses. This is the second chapter of the book. And all of these headless corpses, obviously from the guillotine, have to be processed somewhere. And they do so in this crematorium where they burn them. And sometimes because of the flames and the sheer amount of headless corpses being pushed into these large ovens, you have some of them crackling and moving around in the fire, looking like they're dancing. At least that's how Hina describes it. So he likes to visit the crematorium, the artist, and he likes to look through these portals into this swarm of headless corpses dancing and crackling in the fires. And this inspires him, apparently. And then we get introduced to this graveyard near his home, where the headless corpses that they can't fit into the crematorium are buried. And on each of the grave markers, there is a severed animal head. So suitably grotesque. And you've got a close-up of these animal heads being ravaged by the elements, being, you know, picked apart by crows and other carrion birds and by centipedes crawling through their eye sockets, maggots. Whoa. Maggots is a recurring image in any Hideshi Hino book. And then at night, it seems that the headless corpses wake up and search for their heads. And since they can't find their original heads, they sort of take these animal heads off of their grave markers and put them on and parade around with these animal heads, searching blindly for what they once were. So Hideshi Hino says, "Wow, what a great view. I can see this all from the window of my living room." Then he introduces us to his collection of grotesque paraphernalia. He's got lots of jars filled with weird-looking creatures, mutants, really. Body parts, severed heads, fetuses, stillborn babies. And then we're introduced to his family. Now, it turns out he's got two children, a girl and a boy. And he's just decided, I'm going to be completely unoriginal and call them for, you know, what they are. And he names his girl Crazy Girl and his son Crazy Boy. That's Crazy with a K, by the way. All right, so Crazy Girl takes after her father. She's a mangaka. She's still just a little girl, but she paints these horrific images of people getting murdered. And Hino obviously praises her every time she shows him a new drawing. And then he describes her daily routine. She likes to collect the cadavers of dead little animals and sketch them. And then she also likes to read books by the weirdest manga artists. But as he shows us an image of her bookshelf, it turns out that all the manga that she has in that bookshelf is by an author called Hideshi Hino. And then he shows her in the shadow, laughing and reading one of these manga and grinning an evil grin. And then she also stages these puppet shows for her little brother, who's, you know, obviously called Crazy Boy, as I mentioned before. And one of the puppet shows is, in fact, a reenactment of another story that we'll find in Lullabies from Hell, which we'll talk about later, Zoroku's Strange Disease. So Crazy Girl stages this puppet show and calls it Zoroku's Tumor, which we'll talk about later. All right, so Crazy Boy obviously enjoys this. He loves his little sister's twisted imagination, but he's of an entirely different sort. He likes to wander around outside, running around, kicking the heads of severed animals. He likes to use a type of barge, a raft that he's created from an old broken wooden door to pull himself around on this river of blood outside their home, sort of Karen the ferryman style, you know, pulling himself around on this river Styx. And then, you know, he frequently uses his slingshot to murder unsuspecting animals. They have an image of him using a slingshot to kill a frog. The frog is struck on the head by a stone and falls into the river and dies. And then he also likes to use, as I said, he likes to kick around the heads of severed animals. He goes into the graveyard behind their home, takes a head from one of the grave markers and kicks it around, using foul language as he does so. There's this image of him kicking this dog's head and shouting, "Son of a bitch!" Okay, then he also sneaks into the neighborhood slaughterhouse and collects the eyeballs of dead pigs. And he's seen licking them every time before he puts them into a bag. Okay, I'm laughing here, but, you know, I've got a bit of a grotesque imagination too. So this is portrayed in such a horrible fashion that you just have to laugh in order to make it more palatable. So he shows up and, you know, his dad obviously has a good relationship with him. His dad tickles him and then licks him below the chin in a very grotesque way. But, yeah, he's close to his kids, not in a perverted sense. Sometimes Crazy Boy and Crazy Girl get into fights. But, you know, most of the time they also get along and they cheer as new decapitations commence every day. And there's even some fireworks sometimes. So these decapitations are sometimes celebrated at night with fireworks. And then the kids, Crazy Boy and Crazy Girl, sing this grotesque little song, or they chant this chant, "Guillotine, guillotine, now you have a whole mountain of heads. Guillotine, guillotine, drop another head." All right, so terrible. So very, very terrible. All right, then you get introduced to the artist's wife. Now, she's this very beautiful, this Japanese lady, and she runs a place called Hell Tavern. And her only clients, her only customers, are the headless corpses from the graveyard. At night, obviously, these corpses wake up. They parade around, and they enter this tavern. And when she asks them what they would like to eat or drink, they inevitably say, "I want to eat, you know, my ankle, my hand, some of my own body parts." One even says, "as sashimi," which is like sushi. You know, obviously cut strips from his buttocks that she will do. And then she does, in fact, feed them their own body parts. But how can she feed them, you might ask, because they don't have mouths, they're headless. No, not a problem for her. She takes a butcher's knife and cuts a mouth for them in their throats or in their upper chests. And then she stuffs these body parts that they request through these holes. It's really terribly horrific. And that's basically Hideyoshi Hino's wife. Then we get to a very interesting part of Panorama of Hell, where Hideyoshi Hino describes his ancestry. And he starts with his great-grandfather, who was a roving gambler. His grandfather, who was a roving gambler. And he had a tattoo of a giant snake on his back. Now, these subsequent stories are called Three Generations of Tattoos. So part one is the Snake Man, talking about his grandfather. Now, he was a gambler. When he was successful, he would return home and be in a very good mood. He would spend a lot of money on his family. Everything will be happy. But then his wife would inevitably ask him, okay, before he leaves again to gamble more, how long will he stay away this time? Because she's obviously not happy with him being a gambler. Then, some days or sometimes, he would return months later, and he would look... he would be in a terrible state because he had lost at gambling. And then he would obviously not be in the best of moods. He would come home, he would get drunk, and he would abuse his wife by tying her up in front of the kids mostly and then beating her with a rod or a stick. So this is quite terrible, a terrible thing for kids to witness. Now, this is another thing you'll find in Hideyoshi Hino's books. Kids witnessing horrible events and being scarred by this, and then growing up to be either killers or horror manga artists. Okay, so you don't know how much of this really happened to Hino. I hope none of it, but we know that he was definitely influenced by his near death on the route from Manchuria back to Japan, where some Chinese attacked, obviously in retaliation for the horrors of World War II, and he was severely injured back then. So this might be the only traumatic event from his past, but there might be more. There might be domestic abuse. There might be other things that inspired him. But he definitely shows a lot of domestic abuse in his manga. All right, so when this dad does this to the mom, the kids just look on helplessly. And then Hino describes the story that his father told him of his grandfather's death, which happened one snowy night. Some of his gambling buddies got fed up with his debt, so they decided to murder him. But it turned out the grandfather was quite a handful. He managed to kill most of the killers. But during this fight, his tattoos were exposed, and he was, in fact, disemboweled by one of the killers. And blood spewed out in vast quantities, but not just blood. Also, a heap of gambling dice, which he was ingesting. He was eating the gambling dice that he had used. And a heap of gambling dice spilled out of his guts. And then as they were spilling out, he would grab them and stuff them back into his mouth over and over again until he finally expired there in the snow, in this pool of blood. He almost looked like he was making a snow angel in the blood of the snow. It's quite horrific. And then another blow hit Hino's father and his father's young sister. It turns out after his dad had been killed in the snow, his mother was also murdered brutally by a pervert from the village. And she was literally planted upside down after he had done horrific things to her. She was planted upside down in a flower bed and tied and suspended there to make her look like some horrific human tree. And the kids witnessed that. They saw their mother's dead body, and obviously they didn't have any people to take care of them now. So they were sent away to work with different families. And it was at this time that his father, because of all the traumatic experiences he's, seen in his life, he also got a tattoo, but instead of a snake, his father got a giant crimson bat on his back. So his father had a horrible life when he was working for this family. He had to take care of this crazy person living up in an attic, and the person would abuse him, and then eventually the father fought back and hit this guy that was abusing him with a hammer on his head, and that led to his father, being destitute. He was kicked out of this family, and then he went to try to visit and find his sister, but it seemed that the family who had been in charge of his little sister had worked her to death, literally worked her to death. She had been so, tired and unhealthy. She had expired. She had died from pneumonia, but literally the cause was her, being worked like a slave. So then the father became a vagabond, but eventually he became a gambler as well, just like his father. And he went to Manchuria. This now follows Hideyoshi Hino's actual life. The father went to Manchuria, who worked there hard. He married someone there. We assume a Japanese lady, but it could be a Chinese lady too, a Chinese wife. And then he started working at a pig farm. But he was called to war after Japan declared war on the United States. And he was a soldier then until the end of the war. But he said he was so happy being a soldier, killing and maiming, but the mushroom cloud blew up his dreams of remaining a soldier and maintaining this hobby of his, which was at this time killing American soldiers. So then he was destitute again, but at this point in time he had obviously had Hideyoshi Hino, and Hideyoshi Hino's older brother. And he was abused by his father too. His father beat him up, also tied him up. Bondage is a big thing in Hino's books. And during this horrific abuse sessions, Hino would imagine that the black bat would rise off of his father's back and leer at him from the roof, from the rafters of the home, of his house. So terrible, really terrible. Then his younger brother, who witnessed this abuse, but sometimes stood up for Hideyoshi Hino as he was abused by his father. He also had a tattoo, but he had a dragon tattoo. So far, the grandpa had the snake tattoo, the father had the black bat, and his brother had a dragon tattoo. He became a Yakuza, a member of the Japanese Yakuza, and he was incredibly violent and an almost unbeatable street brawler. He would come home bloody and beaten, but he would never lose a fight. And eventually, he was found dead one cold night, buried beside Hell River, which is this river that runs by Hideyoshi Hino's home. But as it turns out, he was resurrected somehow. and Hino went to visit him in the hospital. Yeah, it by all accounts, he had definitely died, but miraculously had come back. And then on his hospital bed, he told Hino how he would sometimes defend his older brother against the ministrations of their father and against bullies of the neighborhood. And then realizing this, at this point of the narrative, Hino goes crazy. The artist, he goes mad, and then he screams and shouts at the heavens. And then you have these images of flashbacks where it's seen that not only did Hideyoshi Hino's dad abuse him. Okay, this is all a fictional biography, so I'm talking about the artist here. Let's call him the artist. He was abused by the grandmother and the mother as well, because they all went crazy. After the nuclear explosion of Hiroshima, a beam of light struck Hideyoshi Hino's mother all the way in Manchuria. And Hideyoshi Hino says he had a dream that this was how he was conceived. He was a child of the atomic bomb. And he had witnessed everything that happened from the womb of his mother. How in Manchuria, his mother and father were captured by the Chinese. They were almost executed, but a Chinese friend spoke up for them and saved them. And then he was born in Manchuria shortly afterwards, but he was born this grotesque little monstrous figure. And, when he was just a few months old, they had to leave. And then there's this incredibly graphic scene of their caravan of Japanese leaving Manchuria being attacked by these vengeful Chinese who are literally strangling them, ripping them apart. But all the while that these Chinese are enacting this bloody revenge, they're crying, obviously crying for their loved ones and taking this out on the Japanese who tortured and occupied their country. So then Hideyoshi Hino shows himself as a baby crawling in the snow, licking up the blood from the snow because he was just so thirsty, separated from his mother. Oh, man. This stuff really gives me nightmares. Even me. So then we get to Hideyoshi Hino's childhood. He says that he did have some things that amused him, some pleasant days, not just abuse from his family that he suffered. He had times when he would realize that he was an artist. He would experiment on animals and make these grotesque little, basically carvings. He would do some pottery, mostly of the mushroom cloud. And he would sometimes use animal entrails or blood to color his creations. And then he discovered that he had a power. He would pray to this effigy of this mushroom cloud god that he had created and was worshiping by now. And every time he had a prayer which involved death or burning or decapitation, it would come true. It would happen. And this we would find later in Lullabies of Hell too, a painter or an artist with these eerie powers to realize his dreams. His paintings and dreams of hell and death would become a reality. So then we see him praying to this mushroom god of his, this mushroom cloud god. And we see a newspaper clipping saying, disaster, 5 boats sink, 800 dead, double train wreck, death toll, 163, airplane crash. And this is when we enter the final chapter, which is just called the Panorama of the Final Hell, where he's been working on his masterpiece. And he says, this is my masterpiece, and it's going to be the end of the world. I will make a giant portrait of death, and it will result in all the nuclear bombs being fired at the same time. But to do this, he would have to sacrifice his family, his wife and his two children, crazy boy and crazy girl. And he does so, but it turns out that they were not real all along. They were merely mannequins, and the wife was a mannequin, the children were puppets, marionettes that he then chopped apart with this machete. And even the old grandmother who was supposed to live with him was merely a mannequin on this type of mechanism that moved her back and forth across the screen. Then you would see her silhouette moving, but she wasn't real either. So he chopped them all up and then he stood outside with his machete screaming at the crematorium and at the graveyard, and it started to snow, and he threw the machete at the crematorium. The crematorium collapsed from that one throw, and this is all just in his mind. He's completely descended into madness here. And then a highway to hell opened up for him into this giant mouth. Yeah, the doorway to hell is this giant mouth. And along the road to hell, there's this river, the blood river again, of drowning souls screaming for mercy. And then, you know, he saw this bloody revolving lantern in front of him spinning and showing him images of his childhood and the abuse he had suffered. And then he went, if this could be described as going even more insane, he did. And he started shouting and raving at the reader. So this is him breaking the fourth wall here, shouting at us and saying, now you will die. You, the reader, you will suffer. All of you will die. And then he hurls his machete straight at the eyes of the reader as you read this. And that's how it ends. It ends with the thwack of the machete, presumably hitting us, signaling our doom. All right, so that concludes Hideshi Hino's first, the first manga that I read of him, The Panorama of Hell. All right, so we're going to take a little bit of a break. After this disturbing imagery, I think you would all agree, listeners, a break is what we need. And after the break, we'll return with the second volume in Hino's Opus of Hell. So keep listening, if you dare.
It's midnight, the podcasting hour. From fetid swamps to creepy castles, the podcasting hour is your home for horror on the Fire and Water Network. Join me, PJ Frightful, on this quarterly anthology podcast that gazes into the mysterious and terrifying shadows of DC Comics. The moon is full, and the bell tolls for midnight, the podcasting hour.
All right, we're back with our next look at one of Hino's works, this one entitled Lullabies from Hell. And this book was first published by Dark Horse Manga. At that time, this division of Dark Horse was called Dark Horse Manga, in 2005. And my favorite, I would say, of Hino's works. It doesn't just focus on one single subject, which in the previous volume was the artist and all his grotesque nightmares and horrible goings-on. No. This book has four different stories, but also a brief introduction to an insane artist, which again is a fictional autobiography of Hino himself, but a little bit different than the one we found in Panorama of Hell. I'll read a bit of the description of this book from the back cover. They say, "The self-titled first tome introduces you to the author himself, a horror quasi-biography of sorts. The story tells Hino's having willed his pregnant wife into birthing a horrible, planet-devastating reptile baby that eats puppies and children." And you can imagine how these stories progress from there. "Take a look inside the mind of a madman," published in the popular unretouched and unflopped manga format, Lullabies from Hell might make sleeping a bit of a challenge. No doubt. All right, so let's get into this gem of horror manga here. All right, so you've got four stories. The first story is called A Lullaby from Hell. Second one named Unusual Fetus, My Baby. And then the third one, Train of Terror. And the final fourth one is called Zoroku's Strange Disease. All right, so we'll start with Lullabies from Hell, the first story. And again, it introduces Hino as this mad manga artist living in this little shack along Hell River. But this time he's surrounded by factories spewing pollution into the air. And he takes us for a tour, speaking directly to the reader, breaking the fourth wall here. He takes us for a tour through his collection of grotesque paraphernalia once again. He shows us all these formalin jars of dead babies, fetuses, severed fingers, some of the fingers being his own. He likes to sever his own fingers, obviously not the fingers on his drawing hand. And he also collects things from Hell River, puts them into formalin jars, and then he gives a brief history of his life as a child, which is a little bit the same, but also noticeably different from what we found in Panorama of Hell. Basically, his mother was insane, and she would not want to be near him. Every time she sees him, she would scream and shout for the father to take him away. So he never had the love of his mother. And his father was a factory worker. He was always stoic, unapproachable, very strict. So he had no relationship with his father, no relationship with his mother. And even the maid who did the dishes and general housework was indifferent to him. So he had nobody to care for him, nobody to really love him. And his brother, older brother, was a Yakuza, almost the same as the younger brother that we saw in Panorama of Hell. So, of course, you have these discrepancies turning up in these fictional biographies of Hino, or autobiographies, I should say. But he amused himself by torturing animals, as any young serial killer is wont to do, which is very upsetting. I really don't like seeing animal torture in movies, films, manga, but there is a scene, two horrible scenes, in fact, where he tortures a dog and a cat. He burns the cat at a stake, and he ties the dog up and dissects it while it's still alive. So pretty graphic, pretty horrific stuff. And he often had nightmares where he was the ruler of hell. And you see these dreams of demons ripping apart people at his behest. So twisted little kid was Hino, at least in this story, was when he was young. But he used to draw from a very early age, and he drew these horrific scenes of death. And then he discovered his power, which is similar to the artist in the previous volume we talked about, where four bullies accosted him and beat him to a pulp. And then he was so upset by that that he murdered them in his pictures by drawing manga that portrayed their deaths. And the deaths happened exactly like it did in the manga. So they were, in fact, killed by Hino's pen or his pencil. One was crushed by a truck. One was crushed by falling logs. Another drowned in Blood River, and so on and so forth. So he made these little shrines to commemorate their deaths and impaled animals on top of these little wooden poles, these stakes that he planted in the ground to thank whatever hellish god gave him this power. And then another traumatic thing happened in his young life, in his childhood, when his parents discovered his collection of formalin jars with dead animals and fetuses and rats and babies and everything in there. And it upset his mother, who was already crazy, so much that she started screaming nonstop. So his father was angry with him. He tied him up and punished him, beat him for days. Pretty terrible experience for a child. I think he's 10 years old at this time. And then as he was tied up, his father left him tied up for the whole day. So the mother, who had heretofore never really touched him, started to abuse him as well because he was completely helpless. First, she approached him and then verbally abused him and by saying, "You're a devil, a scary little devil. I hate you. I don't love you." And then she ripped out his hair and started beating him with a bamboo rod, with a bamboo stick. So pretty horrific experience for any kid to go through. Then after that day, he wasn't the same. He dreamt of punishing his parents, but he didn't have the guts to do that yet through his drawings. However, it turned out that every night he would pray and sing a lullaby of hell that his mother used to sing to put herself to sleep. And after that, his mother disappeared. And he finally found her in the sewer beneath the city, where her decaying corpse was lying in the bloody water. And he would visit this decaying corpse, and her belly would become bloated and swollen. As I said, Hino is one sick bastard. He comes up with all these horrible things. So then after his mother died, he became more bold. He decided to exercise his power at random at first, but then also he punished people who would slight him. The first was a rival mangaka who he murdered in his comics by having him be struck by lightning. And another one was a friend who took his money and then disappeared with it. He killed him in his manga in a horrific construction accident, which in fact did happen in reality. His brother, whom he always hated, was stabbed to death in a fight with other gang members. His father was crushed in the factory by one of the machines. And an editor who insulted his manga was steamrolled to death in the street. So basically, that's how he ends the story. But there's another disturbing piece, similar to the end of Panorama of Hell, where he threw the machete at the reader. In this manga, he says, "The next person I will kill with my manga." And as we turn the page to the final bit of the story, he points a finger directly at us, the readers, and says, "You, you're dead next. I'm going to kill you in my manga next. That's right. I've already created a voodoo effigy, and I'm going to draw your demise right now in my next horror manga." So that's pretty bad, especially if you're superstitious about death and so forth. A bad omen reading this book because he says he's going to kill the reader next. So that's the first story. Pretty horrific, pretty gross. Then you've got the second one, which is called Unusual Fetus, My Baby. And this is a story about a more straightforward manga, horror manga artist, also presumably Hideyoshi Hino himself, and his wife who became pregnant. All right, so the first page of this story, we see this fetus evolving over a two-page spread. And at first, the fetus is a little ball of sort of looks almost like gelatin, and then it splits into some cells, and then it becomes this scaled thing, almost looks like a tadpole, and then eventually morphs into a more human-looking form. So we have this very interesting few pages that follows this, where he says that fetus dreams are a magnificent drama of human evolution while inside the womb. We start off as a single cell, then like an odd trilobite of the Paleozoic era, or a grotesque Ordovician, or an amphibian on the shore, we eventually morph into the human being we have become to this day. And he gives this brief evolutionary history of dinosaurs perishing, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tigers, and the monkeys descending from the trees, the apes descending from the trees, and eventually evolving into humans. And he ends this bit of evolutionary history with saying, "At long last, people appear, and the dream of the magnificent drama of evolution climaxes." Okay, so you've got Hino then himself as a manga artist, sitting in his backyard with his wife, watching their pets play, talking to his wife, who's pregnant at this time. And, you know, she says, "I wonder if our baby's dreaming," and he listens to the baby in her tummy. Very sweet scene. And then you have another two-page spread which compares the fetuses of different animals, fish, newt, turtle, chicken, pig, human, and it shows that in their early stages of development, they all look the same. They all look similar. They all have the basic building blocks of life, but the evolutionary pattern they display in the very first stage is similar. And then we head over to the next part of the story where a doctor is giving Hideyoshi Hino, this manga artist, the bad news, saying that, "I'm sorry, sir, your fetus, the baby that's been born to your wife, your child, is an unusual fetus, to say the least. It is, in fact, a monster. Your wife has given birth to this animal-like frog, an amalgamation between a frog and a baby dinosaur, at least, creature." So he visits her in the hospital bed where she's allowing this monster to suckle on her. And he says, "We have to give it up. It's a monster. We can't take it home. It can't be our child." And she says, the wife screams at him saying, "No, it's my baby. I'll raise him no matter what. I'll raise him." And then this little monstrous frog thing starts to cry ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki. That's how it cries. And then she hugs it and says, oh, don't cry, my baby, don't cry. So he has no choice but to accede to her wishes. And they take the monster baby home. But the pets that they have, three dogs and a cat, they don't take well to this monster baby. They bark every time they see it. They're violent towards this baby. They want to attack it, rip it apart. And at first, the baby's quite content at suckling from the mother. But later on, it develops a taste for meat, for flesh. But as they're living through this horrible event, the mangaka and his wife read these newspaper articles, which says environmental pollution increases and it has possible effects on fetuses. Monster babies are born to people all over Japan. So this is not an isolated incident. And the manga artist does not take to his new son or daughter. They never tell you what sex it really is, what gender it is. It's sort of asexual. And then he, in fact, becomes angry when he sees that his wife is more attentive to this baby. And she feeds him these raw pieces of meat. And the manga artist says, that's enough. We can't have this kid in this house. And then the kid attacks him. He even bites his finger and there's this gush of blood. So he says, that thing's dangerous. And as the baby grows up, the father's prediction or proclamation turns out to be true. The dogs that they kept as pets have puppies. And we see this monster baby staring through the window, looking at the puppies in the backyard and salivating. So in the days to come, it turns out that all the puppies have been murdered, eaten by the monster baby in their kennels. Even the mother dog has been killed. And even the birds they kept as pets in the in a coop outside, or in this bird box that they had, all eaten and ripped apart by their baby. And then we've got another bit of a newspaper clipping that says, abnormal babies, scientists probe further. Atmospheric pollution spiking, breakdown crisis for humans, hormones out of control, monster babies are born to all new mothers. So the end of humanity, it's kind of an apocalyptic story, is happening in the backdrop of this main story of them raising this monster baby. So this baby is growing gigantic in proportions. It's already at a few months old. It's almost as big as a full-grown man, but it's still living in a crib. And then the most horrific thing in this story happens, where the son of their neighbor is being attacked and, in fact, killed by this monstrous lizard frog thing baby of theirs. And the son has been killed. His dead body's lying in the backyard being licked by their monstrous fetus baby. And one of his eyes are one of the boy's dead eyes is literally falling out of one of the sockets. So this terrible image that Hideshi draws here. And then they decide to cover up the murder of the neighbor's son by burying the kid. And investigators come calling, but there's nothing suspicious about this family. So it's a dead end. And then they, in fact, keep some of the boy's meat to feed the baby, because now the baby only deigns to feed on humans, since it's tasted human flesh. So you have all these newspaper clippings sort of framing this main story, where they say humans at risk of extinction. 50% of human babies are now beasts. And we see pictures of a mother in Africa giving birth to a baboon, a mother in Korea giving birth to this a raccoon type thing, Chinese mother giving birth to a panda baby. It's crazy. It's really crazy. So basically the story ends with the end of the world. People realize that humanity's at an end. No more human babies are born. Only these animals, who aren't necessarily intelligent as humans. They're bestial at best. And there's war, there's revolution, and it ends with the manga artist accepting the situation and then, in fact, deciding to make his wife's dream come true, which is to have a second baby. And the story ends with the wife holding the second baby that has been born to her in her arms, and that turns out to be a crocodile. So that's how the story ends. Really freaky story, but one of my favorites in this book. It's just so out there. Great story. Unusual fetus, my baby. And then we head on into the third story, which is Train of Terror. Now, this is a very straightforward manga story of these school kids traveling on a train, and they go through this, they see this shadowy stranger on the train sitting across from them, and they're freaked out by him. And the train goes through this tunnel, and when it emerges from the tunnel, everybody on the train is subtly different. It's as if the train has taken them into an alternate reality, a parallel dimension, where everything they know is the same, but subtly different, subtly more sinister, subtly more evil. So the kids head home, and it turns out their parents are all different as well. They've got moles where they never had moles before, scars where they never had scars before. Their personalities are different. They're malevolent. They're evil. And these three kids that was on this train, they start to realize that something's up. And their parents also realize that their kids are not who they used to be. So the parents are intent upon silencing these kids or destroying them, killing them, because they turn out to be abnormal for this world. The normal for this world is to be murderous, to be evil, to kill. And these three kids turning out to be good are the enemies of the people in this world. So they're being hunted down one by one by the kids at the school, by their parents. Even the teachers are in on it. And it seems that once darkness descends, the evil in these people are pronounced. It's increased. And they almost become zombie-like. And they hunt down these kids as these zombie-like corpses. But during the day, they transform back into humans, but still evil, just not as evil as they are at night. So the story culminates with one of the kids dying, and then the boy and the girl that survive running away from these, from their parents and from their teachers, chasing them into this abandoned building. And then they try to walk across the building to another building to safety by putting this wooden board between the buildings, but the board collapses. Luckily, the boy's fall is cushioned by debris, but the girl dies in the fall. And then the boy tries his best to escape. He can't. He eventually ends up in this insane bit of the story where he's in an amusement park trying to escape by climbing on a roller coaster. He activates the roller coaster himself, turns it on, gets on it, and then the roller coaster crashes, and he's involved in this horrific crash. He's injured. I don't know why he got on that roller coaster. It just doesn't make any sense, but he eventually ends up in the sewer and escapes that way. But then he exits the sewer and realizes he's in the zoo, in the snake, the reptile house, in fact. And he's almost killed by these giant snakes, these anacondas, these pythons. His parents show up in the zoo. They track him down. He asks a police officer for help. The police officer, although sinister, appears to be willing to help him, but the parents murder the police officer. Then they end up putting him on the train tracks, tying him up and waiting for a train to drive over his dead body and over his body. And they infect, that in fact happens. But then it turns out this was all just a nightmare. He wakes up in a hospital bed. He had an injury. The mom and dad says there was a horrific train accident. He was involved in an accident, and that's why he was just dreaming. Everybody died in the accident, all of his friends. He's the only survivor. So this was all just a terrible nightmare. But as it turns out, at the end of the day, again, his parents become evil. And they do, in fact, turn out to be the parents from his nightmares. So no reprieve for this little kid. It was all a nightmare, but it did turn out to be true. Everything did, in fact, happen the way that it happened in his nightmare. So he did, in fact, enter this parallel reality, then went back into ours, but then slipped back into that reality filled with evil versions of everyone he has ever known. And then the story ends with him screaming himself to sleep. So, Train of Terror. it's almost like the Train to Busan, except, you know, with the Train to Busan, it's a straightforward zombie apocalypse. A lot of Japanese manga, a lot of Japanese films and horror, in fact, involves trains and subways and, you know, sometimes trains entering into different dimensions through tunnels. So this is Hideyoshi Ino playing with a famous manga horror trope. Then we've got the final story, which is very grotesque, very disturbing, vomit-inducing. It's not really scary so much. It's just Hideyoshi Ino drawing what he loves to draw best, which is these gross scenes of decaying and putrescent bodies. And Zoroku's Strange Disease is all about... It's set in the past, probably about 18th or 17th century Japan, and it chronicles this family's woes because they have a son called Zoroku who has this strange disease where these boils break out all over his body. He calls them rainbow-colored neoplasm that erupts all over his face like poisoned mushrooms. So eventually his family can't stand it because these boils, they become infected and they drip this liquid that stinks. So they put him up in the forest in this abandoned cottage. And the village, eventually they all, you know, treat him as a type of boogeyman, this Zoroku. He has to stay, but he also seems feeble-minded. So, you know, he doesn't talk. The mom gives him food every day, but the family urges her not to. They want him to just starve to death. But the mom cannot allow that, so she visits him every day. But eventually, even she has to balk under the pressure because things go poorly for the family. They don't have any more money. They're farmers. You know, there was famine. They couldn't keep up with, you know, even feeding themselves. So eventually they had to abandon Zoroku to his fate in this abandoned hut in the forest. So by this time, Zoroku's all covered in boils. He has to lance them himself with this knife that he heats over a candle flame. And eventually animals show up and they sort of start feeding on Zoroku's body. But at this point in time, Zoroku has become this monstrous figure. Sometimes he walks through the forest and then when people see him on the edge of the forest, they try to stone him to death, but he always escapes back into the dark woods. And everyone's too afraid to visit this house because it stinks and there's animals all about feeding on whatever drips from Zoroku's body. But eventually, some people can't stand it anymore because a storm blows and the wind carries the scent of Zoroku to the village. So the villagers decide they've had enough. They're going to put an end to Zoroku. So they take these sharpened bamboo sticks, head into the forest, and when they happen upon Zoroku, they stab him to death with these bamboo sticks. They impale him on bamboo. And thinking him dead, they leave. But in fact, he hasn't died. His boils sort of saved him from being stabbed to death. And he crawls back into his hut. But at this point in time, he's falling apart. He's dying. And then, you know, there was a terrible snowstorm. And they have to wait for spring because they can't go into the forest. Everything's snowed under. But then eventually the people do head into the forest the next winter to see what happened to Zoroku, what transpired there. And they find everything frozen over, but they see this beautiful rainbow-shelled turtle that crawls out of the house where Zoroku used to live. And the turtle... bleeds, is completely blind. Its eye sockets are filled with pools of blood, but it has this rainbow-colored shell similar to this neoplasm, which Zoroku described as rainbow-colored that dripped from him earlier on. And then the turtle slips away and dives into this river to escape these people. So a very strange, very weird story, Zoroku's Strange Disease. But horror all around, because the way Hino draws it is sort of a mockery of what real animals are supposed to look like. Everything, even the people, they're drawn as these grotesque monstrosities. Everyone's got these protruding, bulbous eyes and these horrific features. Almost look like troglodytes, really. Even the little kids that Hideyoshi Hino draws are suitably cute, but in a grotesque kind of way, if I can describe it like that, similar to the Hell Baby that we discussed in the interlude to this episode. So basically, that concludes Hideyoshi Hino's Opus of Hell. Now, to give a bit of a rating to the books, I've decided to use our unusual fetus rating system. if we're, you know, taking a cue from his story, Unusual Fetus. And for Panorama of Hell, the first book we discussed, I would have to give that a 3 out of 5 unusual fetuses, because it, though very disturbing, it doesn't really have a coherent story, and it is basically smatterings of his life all put together. And he really tries to shock the reader, and doesn't always try to frighten the reader. So he relies a lot on shock value, or on, as Stephen King calls it, the gross out. But it works if you're into being disturbed, if you like to be shocked, if you like to be appalled by horror comics, this definitely will suit your fancy. And then the second volume I have a greater fondness for, Lullabies from Hell. I'll have to give that 4 out of 5 unusual fetuses. That really impressed me. 4 short stories of horror. My favorite would probably be the unusual fetus story, because that's the most frightening and apocalyptic. The weakest one would be Train of Terror. It's too straightforward. Not terribly original. Zoroku Strange Disease, also not a favorite of mine. It's too grotesque, too horrible for me to actually say I would like it. But it does serve its purpose, which is to gross you out. And then the first story I would say is the second best, which is The Lullaby from Hell, about this manga artist with the power to cause death through his drawings and illustrations. So that's it for our main segment, Hideyoshi Hino's Opus of Hell. Read it if you're into Japanese horror manga. It's very different from the Junji Ito's stuff. Junji Ito draws these beautiful images juxtaposed with horror, whereas everything in Hideyoshi Hino's stable of art and drawings and manga would be described as ugly by comparison, but that's what makes him such an effective horror manga artist. So check it out if you can. It's hard to find, I would say, if you want to pick up Panorama of Hell or Lullabies from Hell, you'll have to check eBay. They might also be available on archive.org, where they archive English manga that has been out of print and has presumably lost. It's in the public domain. So you might find it on archive.org. I was fortunate enough to find them early on in the early 2000s. They were still available on Amazon, and that's how I got a hold of them. So, but if you want to read the actual paperbacks, eBay would probably be your best bet. All right, we're going to take another little bit of a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss some history of Japanese horror in terms of Japanese comics, that is. I can't begin to cover the entire history of horror in Japan because most of their horror is situated in film and in novels, but at least I made a workable chronology of horror comics and how they came to be in Japan. So stay tuned for that.
History of Horror. This week, we'll be looking at the genesis of Japanese horror manga. We hope that it will prove informative and suitably nightmarish.
All right, listeners, I'm back. with a bit of info on the history of Japanese horror. All right, well, to understand the genesis of Japanese horror manga, we have to go way back to the Edo period of Japan, which was a time where everybody was superstitious. Everyone believed that there were ghosts roaming the countryside, monsters ran around. And this was during roughly 1603 to 1868, so more than 250 years. And everyone, the whole country, was in fact consumed with a belief in the supernatural. And most of these stories of what the Japanese called yokai, which is their names for ghosts or monstrous or supernatural entities, most of these yokai stories came from a game that they played during the Edo period. And this game was called Hayukama no Gatari Kaidankai. And roughly translated, it's a gathering of 100 weird tales. So now we get to another influence on Japanese horror in general, also on horror films. And that was this idea of the kaidan, or the kaidankai, as they call it in Japanese, which is weird tales with often with a moral, almost similar to a parable or a fable, but featuring horror elements or archetypes such as ghosts or yokai. And then much later, the Japanese theater of kabuki and also the no theater also had an influence on the manga artists of the 20th century and the filmmakers, of course, because these kabuki and no theater plays would normally feature demons, ghosts, or monsters. So the way that the people during the Edo period played this game of Haya Kumo no Katari Kaidankai was to basically light 100 candles in a single room and then take turns telling stories. So they would all gather together, a whole family or friends, and they would light these candles, 100 candles in all, and then they would tell stories. And every time someone has finished telling a story, they would douse a single candle. And then the room would gradually become darker and more sinister, more eerie, upping the tension evoked by these horror tales that were being told. So, of course, the people swapped stories that they had heard from others, but they also told ancient legends from mythology and so forth, or sometimes they just made it up. But they needed to make it really spooky. And definitely this, inspired a lot of the early horror tales, oral in most cases, since back then most of the history was oral in Japan. All right, so basically the Edo artists and writers of that time, they saw an opportunity to make some cash, to make a good living off of this belief in yokai, and they began to produce these little art books called kaidanshu. And this is where the kaidan weird tales actually started to take off, because these books sort of propagated the popularity, of course, and the ideas of these supernatural beings existing. And everyone believed it. It wasn't like fiction nowadays. Yeah, it was accepted that these stories written down in these kaidanshu books or art print books were real. So, most of the stories featured bizarre monsters, ghosts, but some stories came from China or India, since some of these people had traveled that far during that time and they brought stories back with them. And then a man called Seiken Toriyama decided to catalog all the stories and all the monsters and yokai featured in the kaidanshu in 1776, and he compiled an encyclopedia of sorts called the Gazu Hakiyagyo, which is translated as the Illustrated Night Parade of 100 Demons. So that was an early form of visual art and a comic book, even though it wasn't sequential. It didn't tell tales sequentially. It was more like a DC's Who's Who or a Marvel's official handbook where they feature the characters, their skills, the dangers that they offered to the people of the countryside, these poor peasants who believed anything they heard. And that's basically how the Japanese horror literature started. Obviously, that we could study and catalog, because there's a lot of gaps to be filled in. We don't really know much about the early 20th century, other than there were early Japanese films before World War I, before World War II even, and they featured quite a number of horror stories based on the Kabuki and No theaters and the Kaidan. All right, well then, after World War II, you had this massive manga explosion in Japan. You had shonen manga, which was aimed at boys or young adult, male adults, and then you had shoujo manga, which was aimed at the young females. And these magazines were very popular. And they became widespread shortly after World War II. Then they focused on more realistic stories, portraying family life and hardships suffered because of the Great War. But also, in the early 50s, they started focusing on topics like science fiction. And here we get to someone who's known as the godfather of Japanese manga, Osamu Tezuka. His early work, of course, was heavily inspired by Walt Disney. So it didn't actually feature a lot of horror. But because of his success at manga and then later animation, he's not only responsible for Astro Boy, but also for Blackjack and Kimba the White Lion. Because of his success, it emboldened and inspired other Japanese manga artists to try their skills at this artistic craft, which was then paying dividends. But not a lot of horror artists came out of the 1950s. It actually all started round about 1967, and a couple of famous mangaka were involved in getting horror on the map in terms of comic books at that time. And first, it was a man by the name of Kazuo Umizu. Now, Kazuo Umizu, he started publishing as early as 1962, and he was not famous yet, but he started doing horror manga. And then in 1968, he hit the big time with a series called Cat-Eyed Boy, which featured this demonic half-human, half-cat boy that destroyed or fought monsters and demons. Lots of yokai, lots of ghosts, lots of horrific images, but drawn in a cartoony style inspired by the style of Osamu Tezuka. If you've ever seen Astro Boy, or as he's known in Japan, Tetsuwan Atom, you'll know what kind of animation style I'm referring to. So basically, he hit the big time, this Kazuo Umizu. And in a couple of years later, 4 years later in 1972, he published The Drifting Classroom, another horror series, also drawn in this cartoonish style, but he had improved his craft and made the series even more creepy, creepier by far than Cat-Eyed Boy, at least in my opinion. And it featured a tale of this classroom being displaced into another reality, a reality of death, of demons, of hauntings. And it featured the lives of these students as they were slowly destroyed and killed one by one. So Kazuo Umizu. But at the same time, it wasn't just him that started the horror manga craze. Famous manga artists who were not known for horror, such as Go Nagai, in 1971, he even started publishing horror manga. It started with his one-shot, Susumu-chan Daishok. It's a story about a violent collapse of parent-child relationships and children killing parents, parents killing children in turn. And then he kept going with the horror trend because obviously it was selling. It was doing really well in these shonen magazines, which featured at first mostly these male mangaka's works. And he even did a series called Gensu Kyofu Hanashi, which is a very, very disturbing comic. Well, by all accounts, I have not, in fact, read it. This is just gleaned from numerous interviews with other mangaka about what inspired them. But it's roughly based on a story by Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, who wrote Camilla. And it is called, or at least translated as, The Strange Event in the Life of Shalkin the Painter. And he did an adaptation of that, and it was an instant hit. And then a little later, he started going into more occult horror manga. This is now in the 1970s with stories like Mao Dante. And all of this eventually led up to his seminal horror creation, Devil Man. And if you are at all familiar with Netflix, Devil Man Crybaby is a series that's on there at the moment. But the Devil Man manga has been running for a very long time, for 30-odd years. So he was quite a big influence on the early horror comics in Japan in the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s. And then you had Osamu Tezuka himself. He was actually, at that point in time, fighting against the more realistic style that was cropping up among Japanese artists and comic book artists at the time. So he tried his hand at more adult-oriented stories, such as his Apollo Song, which was published in 1971. It borders on science fiction, but it's mostly horror. It features an abused and neglected boy called Shogo, who was abused by his mom, and you know, he never knew his father, and his mom was basically a prostitute, and he saw all these men come and go, and almost similar to the origin of Watchmen's Rorschach, if we can bring it back to the DC universe for a bit, where, you know, you witness horrible things as a child, and then there's a psychological break. And in Shogo's case, he can't feel love. He's unable to feel love, so he tries to feel something. So at a young age, he starts torturing and killing animals in order to, you know, this is now an early serial killer in the making, in order to see if he can feel something. But then he is visited by a goddess who sends him to different time periods. She basically kills him, and then he's reincarnated in different time periods to get to know love, to understand love. But every single period he's reincarnated in is horrific. Like this one story featuring him reincarnated as a German soldier who falls in love with a Jewish girl, and then he's forced to watch as she is violated and killed by his fellow German soldiers on this farm. It's really disturbing. And then he dies defending her. So, yeah, even Osamu Tezuka tried his hand at horror. And I think his greatest work, in my mind, came when he did a series called MW in 1976. Basically, it's a story about the Japanese fear of nuclear bombs, radiation, chemical attacks, all of that. And these boys, this boy in accompaniment with this older boy who would one day become a priest, visits this island where there was a chemical leap, a chemical spill, and then one of the boys becomes affected. The chemical spill, in fact, changes his mind. Evolves it, at least that's what he says, and he becomes a killer. He becomes completely evil. So having started out as an innocent boy, this chemical has warped his brain, and he becomes this force of terror, killing people at random for no reason, really, other than to satisfy his own pleasure. So yeah, MW by Osamu Tezuka, also one of the seminal early horror manga works. And then we get into the 80s. Obviously, I'm glossing over Hideshi Hino's stuff here because I already mentioned him. He made it big in the early 70s too with his theater of horror stories. And then we get into the 80s, and we had in 1981 a very, very important bit of horror manga published by none other than Katsuhiro Otomo, who would later go on to create the seminal manga Akira. Whereas Akira is a little bit of a horror story, but mostly science fiction, this series that I'm talking about is called Domu, Child's Dream, and it was published in 1981. And it is a horror story of these two godlike beings living in an apartment building, playing with people's lives, battling each other. One is in the form of an old man, one is in the form of a young girl. And they basically play horrific games with the lives of the tenants in this apartment building. So after that, horror just went all across the map, or manga, I should say. Lots of new artists came and went, and lots of mangaka who weren't famed for horror works tried to get in on the genre because it was so lucrative. And now we have all this horror manga permeating the market in Japan, of course, and also internationally. So lots of great series out there. Of course, this is before the rise and popularity of Junji Ito, who had his heyday in the late 80s and early 90s, and also in the 2000s. He's since published lots of new material, but you know, his newer stuff doesn't have the impact of his earlier works. At least I think so. But he now is called the grandmaster of Japanese horror manga. But, you know, this is chronicling the history, not the modern age. We'll talk again about what happened after the 90s and later on into the 2000s when I do a show in the future about Junji Ito stuff. I'm really looking forward to that. Hopefully we can get a guest on, a Junji Ito fan. I'm still seeing if that's possible to talk to us about his manga. But that's a short, abbreviated version of a Japanese history of horror comics. Actually, there is no scholarly work published about this topic yet. I've had to look at lots of interviews, some YouTube content, lots of old magazine articles featuring translated interviews with manga artists and so forth to cobble together this little bit of history. And there's also a fair bit of conjecture thrown in, so forgive me. But as far as I know, everything is accurate, everything I've mentioned. So if you're interested, have a bit of research. It's hard to find this information on the internet. I really struggled, but eventually after weeks, I did manage to create a working chronology of how the events that shaped modern horror manga came to be. So that's it for our History of Horror segment, listeners. We're going to take another short break, and then we'll be back with some horror comic recommendations. So don't go away now. Before we get to the recommendations, I had some feedback this month from one of our listeners, from Jason Zeller, to be exact. Jason sent me an email. He says, "Herman, I just wanted to let you know that I really love the podcast. Comics in general and horror comics are one of my favorite subjects. I tend to like more older classic horror comics such as EC Comics Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, Haunt of Fear." Jason grew up in the 1980s and 1990s, so he read those reprints and he really enjoyed them. He's also a fan of DC's horror anthology comics, such as House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Ghosts, The Witching Hour, and so forth. And the covers of those comics really pull him in, and the stories captured his imagination. And then Jason gave me a compliment on Creepshow, my very first episode. Thank you, Jason. And he said The Crate was the scariest story for him. Yeah, Jason, that's a damn scary story, man. I love that tale. And he also says that Richard Corbin is one of his favorite horror artists. He loved the House of Mystery episode I did. The Weird War Tales is probably his favorite death is also his favorite horror host, just like he is mine. And he loves The Art of Joe Kubert. He also compliments Aaron, who's in fact not here. Jason, sorry about that. Aaron couldn't make it this week. And he says he loves her enthusiasm. Wow, I didn't know she had any, Jason. No, I know you're being sarcastic there. And then Jason gave me some very important info here. He was listening to one of my earlier History of Western Horror Comics segments when I talked about horror comics from the 1940s. And he says that one of the early horror comics, Adventures into the Unknown, number 17, featured a story called The Beast from Beyond. And the original story, in fact, was a tale called Who Goes There? A short story by John W. Campbell from 1938. Now, this information is all from Jason, so I appreciate this, Jason. And Jason goes on to say that it was actually a novella, and it inspired both The Thing from Another World movie from 1951, as well as John Carpenter's The Thing. So I didn't, in fact, know that. I knew that The Thing was inspired by The Thing from Another World, but I didn't know that it came from the John W. Campbell story. And I also didn't know that The Beast from Beyond in Adventures into the Unknown is, in fact, based on Campbell's story as well. And Jason goes on to say that the aspect of the original story, the comic adaptation, and the Carpenter movie captures the paranoia of not knowing who the thing is and not knowing who you can trust very well. And he says another interesting note on the story is Peter Watts' The Things, which tells the story from the perspective of the alien. Okay, so an author called Peter Watt wrote a story where it's the alien who observes events, the alien from The Thing. Now, Jason, I've yet to read those. I will, and then I'll come back to you. I'll send you an email with my thoughts on those. Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate the feedback. Thank you. All right, everybody, that's it for our feedback. We'll get back to our recommendations in just a moment. Alright, it's recommendation time, listeners. I've been looking through my horror manga here, and other than just recommending the expected most popular manga, such as Kurosagi Corpse, The Literary Service, or Junji Ito's stuff, or I Am a Hero, all of that, I've decided to go with something a bit obscure. It's a manga volume called H.P. Lovecraft's The Hound and Other Stories, adaptation and artwork by Go Tanabe. Right, so basically what this is it's a manga take on two or three of Lovecraft's stories. The Temple, The Hound, and yeah, those two. And then basically it is done in the horror manga style, which lends an added sense of eeriness and horror to these two tales, I think. It's all in black and white, of course, as most manga is, published by Dark Horse, H.P. Lovecraft's The Hound, and other stories. Now, what it really does for me is it shows me how much of an influence Lovecraft was on the Japanese. They do love him over there. They love his stories. There's always some of his books in print, some of his short stories in collections available in Japanese all over the country. I've been to Japan many times since I live nearby. We're here in Taiwan, in Taipei, so it's just 2 hours away on the air, on an airplane. So I do get there often, and I always see some Lovecraft books in every bookstore. They love them over there. And now this Go Tanabe has taken it upon himself to publish quite a few of these Lovecraft volumes, but this is the only one that has been translated into English so far. and published by Dark Horse. So I would definitely recommend it. The temple is especially creepy. And then the hound is also scary. And then there's a third story I forgot to mention, The Nameless City. I'm glancing through it right now. It's been a while since I read this, but I remember loving it. I've yet to read it a second time. I probably will right now, right after I finish recording, because it's that good. But the first story has really stayed with me for a long time, the original Lovecraft tale, as well as this manga adaptation, The Temple, where this German submarine finds this underwater city, which turns out to be an abode of the Deep Ones, and how the crew, one by one, disappears and gives themselves up to the ocean, and at the end only the captain remains, a pessimist by heart. That's why he survived all these strange goings-on. Great, great adaptation of The Nameless City. So pick that up. H.P. Lovecraft's The Hound and Other Stories by Go Tanabe. Well, that's it for another episode of The Long Box of Darkness. If you want to reach me, if leave any feedback, you can even leave some MP3 voice mails for me. Please do so at darklongbox@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @darklongbox or visit the blog at www.longboxofdarkness.com. I'd appreciate that. And with that, it's good night for me. And pleasant screams, dear listeners. Pleasant screams.